of Economics, the podcast series of Bruegel, the Brussels-based economics think tank. In today's episode, we look at the economic developments in Turkey. In December of last year, the level of inflation stood at 36%, the interest rate at 40%, and the Turkish lira lost about 45% of its value against the dollar last year, possibly the worst year in two decades. The volatility and uncertainty that such financing conditions create have contributed to a broader trend of the last decade where the average Turkish consumer has seen their income lose about one-third of its value with regards to the dollar. Developments in 2021 have caused a further and severe drop on real incomes in Turkey. What are the circumstances that have contributed to these developments? And crucially, what is the outlook for Turkey? My name is Maria Demergis, and to discuss these issues, I'm joined today by two distinguished Turkish scholars, Elina Rybakova.
Hi, very nice to be here. Thank you.
Hi, Elina. Thank you for joining us. Elina is the Deputy Chief Economist at the Institute for International Finance in Washington, and Refet Gurkayanak.
Hi, very nice being here.
Thank you for coming. Refet is a professor of economics at Bilkin University in Ankara. Thank you both for joining us. And both of you have studied Turkey extensively. Refet, you also live now in Turkey. You are Turkish yourself. There is some very interesting developments there. Let's just take stock first. I've given you some of the numbers. Can I ask you, Elina, to sort of walk us through perhaps the developments of last year, if not earlier in the decade, to simply understand what brought us here?
Well, I think what brought us here is trying to pursue too many objectives with a limited number of instruments. This is the classical economics issue. Clearly, there are possibilities of maybe sort of doing that some of the time in some episodes, but it's not possible to do that continuously. And I think that's my key concern. So if one wants to have current account surplus, low inflation, low interest rate, strong credit growth, all of them at the same time continuously is not possible. And I think that is a key issue here. If you indeed step back for, as you say, a few decades, I think my first concern was unanchoring of inflation expectations in Turkey, which started happening already a while back. And yeah. We talked to a lot of analysts who say that, look, but, you know, Turkish households are very active investors. They invest in different currencies. They even now beginning to invest in Bitcoin. It is true, but the reason they're driven to those different instruments, foreign exchange or other types of non-lira investments, is because inflation expectations are not well anchored. And that's where they're looking at the exchange rate. That's where they're looking to increase their dollar holdings. That is my very strongly held personal view. And if you studied it, even if I say 5 years, 7 years ago, you already in econometrics models, you could see inflation expectations being unanchored. Of course, now we're talking about 30, potentially 50% inflation this year. That's definitely is clearly a big change. So I think the final straw that happened last year, especially towards the second half of the year, when many were expecting the central bank to be on hold, is this sort of complete pivot to what they call the new economic model, when they started cutting rates into increasing inflation and thinking that lira depreciation will help them on the current accounts surplus potentially. But of course, not thinking about what's going to happen to inflation with the very sharp depreciation of the lira and current inflation expectations.
Let's take some of them one by one, because there's a lot of information here. Let's start with your first point, Elina, and from my turn to Refet, the pursuit of too many objectives. Refet, do you agree with that? And how would you verbalize it? As of what is it that we are trying to pursue that is not consistent with each other? Effectively, that's what you mean, Elina, right?
So there are, I would say, at least two issues here. One is not specific to Turkey, which is central banks becoming too much of forefront policymakers for all kinds of oftentimes worthy policy objectives, which cannot be handled by central banks. But somehow there is a global feeling that if policy is needed, central bank will do it. And so, you know, if the question is inflation, central bank, if it's employment, central bank, right, if it's carbon reduction, central bank, then that quite doesn't work because central banks do not have the tools to tackle all of these things together. In Turkey, this manifests itself particularly gravely, both because other policymakers have mostly abdicated and the central bank has lost, due to bad personnel management as well, so much of its human capital that, you know, they find standard central banking not all that easy either. Recall that this is a central bank with embarrassingly high policymaker turnover, right? Many with less than a year of tenure, and central bankers being brought in with the explicit mandate to reduce interest rates. And when they grow a backbone and drag their feet, to be replaced.
If I may, you're talking about the governors effectively, right?
Yes, no. But similarly applicable to, you know, career bureaucrats, economists at the central bank too. The loss of blood there is very upsetting. But the issue indeed is there's this desire to have simultaneously a lower current account deficit, faster growth, faster employment creation, lower inflation, credit growth, you name it. And oddly, an understanding, let me call it, that lowering policy rates will simultaneously achieve all of these.
Okay, and that's what Galina called the new macroeconomic model, right? I mean, yeah, we can talk about this a little bit because that is indeed not what we have learned in on monetary policy school books, if I may call it this way. So it does sound a little bit paradoxical. But let's go back a little bit to this issue of the central role of the central bank in pursuing all this, right? As you say, there are too many objectives to be pursued by one institution. Is that because other institutions are weak? Or why is there so much burden being put on the central bank, RFED?
It's a combination. I would say all institutions are weak now. Presidential system we're operating in isn't very amenable to having any strong institutions other than the president himself. So it applies equally to the central bank, but the treasury and to, you know, foreign policy or the statistical agency. But a lot of it is a deep-seated belief by the president that interest rates are bad and lowering interest rate in itself is a good thing, which will lead to good outcomes on all fronts. And in particular, in a cost channel-ish argument, lowering interest rate is going to lower inflation.
So can you explain the cost channel for our audience, if you don't mind?
I'm being very gracious here. This is not uttered. It's just that to lower inflation, we have to lower interest rates. Interest rates is the cause. Inflation is the response, is the language that we hear. If you want to say it in an economist's terms, it would be you lower interest rates, interest rate expenditures of firms go down, and they reflect it in their pricing. And therefore, inflation goes down. That's the cost channel. And for some firms, in some cases, this channel might be applicable, but overall, around the world and in Turkey, econometric evidence and our theoretical understanding strongly says the demand effect is much stronger. Even in a case with anchored inflation expectations, the demand effect is much stronger. In an institutional setting like Turkey's, where the central bank isn't all that credible, lowering interest rates makes it all the more palpable, the feeling that the central bank isn't credibly committed to keeping inflation down, credibly committed to keeping the purchasing power of the currency. And this has all kinds of pathological effects, including dollarization, right? The lira, our currency, loses its function as a store of value, and therefore two-thirds of deposits in the country are now foreign currency deposits. Yeah. You know, it's not all that difficult, right? As inflation is going up, you see your central bank lowering interest rates. Your currency is losing value against goods and services. Would you want to save in this currency? Well, if you're rewarded amply, perhaps. But in an environment where, you know, the policy rate is 14%, this is 1-4, right? And the inflation is 36%. You know, you don't have to be an economist to say no to this.
Yeah.
Right? So that's where we are.
That's where we are. So, Alina, you talked about, as a center part of all of this, the anchoring of expectations, or as the Fed said, the anchoring of expectations, right? Walk us a little bit through how that works and what is done to Turkey, the anchoring of expectations. Surely this is a reflection of a lack of confidence that goes beyond just credibility, right?
I think it's something that also took place slowly much earlier than just last year or last 5 years. I think it's that something that's been happening almost over the decade now, was this sort of the early days of the policy of pursuing too many potentially conflicting objectives and, you know, talking about the exchange rate while at the same time talking about inflation, having multiple instruments, having this multiple ideas, how this sort of the dynamic mechanisms of reserves management and borrowing reserves from your own banks can work. And I think that sort of laid a dangerous foundation for eventually losing track in communication and also as the objective of the central bank of inflation. So I think it started there. There was a chance to correct it many times over the last, say, let's say 8 years. But every time we took sort of, it's like a decision tree, but every time in that decision tree, we took a path that ignores inflation and inflation expectations and communication and bringing it down. And we pursued other objectives that Refet also talked about. And I think that's eventually took us to this final point where inflation in our forecast is definitely going to be over 40% this year and potentially up to 50%. And we shouldn't forget that in addition to core inflation dynamics, we also have administrative price changes, we have the minimum wage increases, which will also all feed in through, as well as energy prices this year. And that's something the central bank doesn't have direct control over. But if when it's coming on top of 30% inflation, of course, there is a risk of completely runaway inflation and further dollarization. Just to put it very briefly in sort of global context, I do want to say that, of course, it's unfair in a way, right? Because developed markets could pursue much more stimulative monetary and fiscal policies last year, while a lot of emerging markets have already had to tighten, even before the Fed, right? We, of course, we're not going to discuss US inflation here either, but it's a separate conversation. But again, the developed markets had more room to try to bring the economies on a more even keel after big original COVID shock. Now we have other sort of aftershocks. But of course, emerging markets had to react sooner. That has something to do with their lack of depth of financial markets and institutional capacity. But of course, then the Turkish authorities might think that, wait a second, why can't we do the same?
Can I just ask, just to clarify, you said it's unfair. Unfair is the ability to, this need to return faster to some sort of normality on the fiscal side. That's what you mean by unfair, given, of course, the COVID shock. Still there,
I think that's what I mean. I think this eternal conversation that emerging markets are not the same as developed markets. Their ability to carry debt or the ability to sort of to continue with stimulative policies is not the same.
Exactly.
And that's the reality, the macroeconomic reality of it is, even though that from the social economic point of view, it is unfair and the citizens might not be very happy with that. And I worry when sometimes people take this argument too far, and I think Turkey is that example. You know, yes, it's unfair, so why don't we try to do, you know, why don't we try to have low rates and at the same time stimulate growth for longer? We still have COVID going on. But unfortunately, it doesn't add up. It doesn't work this way, especially when it's coming on top of the already unanchored inflation expectations and poor policy choices before, during the good periods as well.
So it's really the risk premium, effectively, what you say. They need to carry out a fiscal stimulating policy given the external shock, but the developed world has more capacity to absorb the riskiness that comes with expansionary policies, right?
Absolutely. And indeed. I think this risk premium is also related to the depth and the liquidity of the domestic financial systems and the quality of the institutions, as well as many other factors. And I think that's where, you know, we can talk a little bit more about it, the sort of the IMF's desire to work with this integrated policy framework, acknowledging that and acknowledging some sort of exchange rate management mechanisms and or potentially capital controls is useful. I think it's a very open and useful debate, but at the same time, it's also a dangerous debate, which gives a mandate, appears to give a mandate to countries to go more into administrative controls.
That's a very important topic. Can I bring you this conversation?
Yes, please.
With 40% inflation and a silent dollarization, silent in the sense that it just it creeps up on everybody, right? The potential for capital controls is really the next, dare I say, instrument? Can I call it instrument or is it a last resort type of instrument? And if the IMF is encouraging it, where are we going with this?
Capital controls aren't one thing, right? It's a very broad menu of things countries are able to implement to, as the term goes, throw sand in the wheels of international finance. And in Turkey's case, some of these are already in place, taxing, buying and selling of foreign currency, moral suasion on banks to encourage their customers to switch from foreign currency accounts to domestic currency accounts and things of that sort. I would say some financial markets regulation makes sense. And capital controls have a bad rep, but some of those also make sense. But they make sense when you are controlling capital that's coming in. They make sense when a country says, you know, I seem to be attracting too much hot money. I don't know what to do with this. it's going to lead to, you know, property price boom or asset price boom, or it's going to all go to non-tradables, and it's going to cause a problem when the time comes to pay this back. So I should not be attracting all of this. But if you have already attracted the foreign capital, and now you're trying to institute capital controls to keep it in, that usually doesn't work all that well. And this is the fundamental problem, right? Capital controls oftentimes are considered for countries that are doing something right. Because they are doing something right, they have this inflow of foreign capital, which should be controlled somehow. And that hence the capital control. But the Turkish case is we're not doing anything right. And the fundamental problem is with the Turkish policies. So everything else turns into, in a sense, second best policies, where we're instituting, you know, one kind of odd policy to offset the effects of another kind of odd policy, and then coming up with a yet another odd policy to offset the effect of the one that we've just invented. And that's not a very sustainable way of doing any policy.
That's right.
Right. So yeah. Here, the issue is, as long as your real policy rate is minus 22%.
That's right.
I don't have to finish the sentence, right? As long as that, things won't work well, right? And so, you know, you do capital controls, you encourage people to do this, you do fiscal policy, whatever, but your central bank has abdicated. And in that case, it's very difficult to imagine your currency being used as a currency or having value, you know, against goods or services or against other currencies. In the end, in the world of fiat money, money that is not backed by commodity that we are living in, the only thing that takes money is our faith in the central bank that it's going to keep doing its job. And in the future, this intrinsically worthless piece of paper will still be treated as money. When the central bank says, I'm not interested, I will only lower interest rates regardless of the circumstances, it's very difficult to convince people to treat this currency as money.
Yeah, it's interesting. Let's try and go through this, what you're suggesting, Rafael, which is let's try and do the right policies here. So let's say increase the interest rate so that we can talk about the price of money being something slightly not so negative as it is now in real terms. An interest mm-hmm. rate at the moment at 40%, 14%. Inflation at, what did you say, Elena? 40%? It's something like that. So, you know, you would need to have the nominal interest rate make a jump to... 40%, 45%, they're such that you can come down to real rates that are kind of much more kind of, you know, what we know. What would that do as a shock if you were to increase nominal interest rates from 14 to 40 in order to try and correct what you just said, Rafat, the bad policies? What would that do in the transition?
You probably wouldn't have to do as drastic a policy, right? The understanding that the central bank is back in play, and you know, they are able to raise interest rates as they see fit, is going to by itself lead to an anchoring of expectations. And what matters, of course, isn't you know, inflation is something that has happened, right? What matters is expected inflation, because we're doing transactions today to be paid back a year from now, right? So yeah. If you're able to control expected inflation, and there are many ways of doing so, right? You change the central bank law, make it clear that the central bank governor cannot be fired, you know, put a bunch of good economists there who say, you know, we understand, exactly, right? We understand that our job is to make sure that inflation is low and we don't care about anything else,
yeah.
Right? They wouldn't have to raise interest rates all that much to begin with. And let me also note this, this is a really interesting and important point. The only interest rate in the country that has gone down is the central bank's policy rate. All other interest rates are going up like gangbusters. Deposit rates, lending rates, you know, consumer credit rates, firm loan rates, whatever, because the central bank says, okay, I'm going to provide liquidity to the banks at 14%. Fine, right? But then at the end of the day, when I see inflation at 36% and expected to be there or higher, who in his right mind would do any transaction at 14% interest? So a very obvious and forecastable result of this policy action was the loss of the monetary transmission.
Indeed.
That the central bank is no longer able to affect market rates. So the central bank is lowering interest rates, and the treasury's borrowing rate, for example, is soaring, right? Because given inflation and inflation risk, of course, the treasury has to pay more now to borrow than before, and everybody have to pay more now to borrow than before.
So the risk premium effectively is all gone through the risk premium, right? We talked about the internal side. Can we talk a little bit about the external side? I mean, about the exchange rates, about the reserves. I was looking at the numbers earlier on, and you know, there's some big movements there. The central bank lost, or rather used, I should say, $7 billion just in December to try and control of these reserves, to try and control the value of the currency. The current account position had been improving from a deficit position steadily over the past decade. I think it even had 1 year where it was actually in a surplus position. It deteriorated again in 2020 and improved again, improved in the sense it came back to a stable current account. But all of this had an incredible cost of the reserves of the central bank, right, Lina?
Absolutely. I think the current account improvement you saw across countries during 2020 and also 2021, I mean, a sort of a smaller deterioration in 2021. This is partially, to a large extent, this is because of the global pandemic, right? So you had lockdowns, and that also had an effect on the current accounts. And we've seen current account surpluses in countries we haven't seen them for decades. It is not something that will necessarily be lasting, especially once we have normalization and reopening and improvement in domestic demand. And we saw a little bit of that in Turkey. Also, we had stronger demand for some of the Turkish exports earlier last year, partially because of the value chains and extremely high cost of shipment from Asia, for example, to Europe. So that gave an extra boost to Turkish exports for a moment, something that is unlikely to be repeated. Lira depreciation helped on the current account, but of course came at the cost of high inflation, just we talked about. And if you look at the most recent numbers on the current account, it's again back to sharp worsening. And it's not unexpected given the high energy, global energy crisis, and Turkey still is an energy importer. I wouldn't sort of a pat on the shoulder too much because of the current account, brief current account surplus we saw. I think it's still a very risky situation. On the reserves, we've seen some announcements of swap agreements, and we just saw one today with UAE. So that helps a little bit to improve gross numbers. We've also supposedly seen announcement from this, we had an announcement from the central bank saying that there will be more public about the interventions, albeit you still saw potentially some hidden interventions at the same time. And we know that reserves, some of this, a big chunk of this reserve are borrowed reserves. They're not actually genuinely of the central banks, but they belong to the banks. So that's something to watch out for.
I mean, what do you mean they are borrowed reserves?
So the central bank has some of the reserves that commercial banks have deposits in Turkish lira, and they can place that with the central bank and that gets counted as part of their gross reserve numbers. And that's sort of something that on a net basis is not actually the accumulated reserves of the central bank. There's been this mechanism has been used in Turkey for years, for decades, well, not that decades, actually a decade at least, but with different versions, and Refet will correct me where I'm wrong. And there are arguments about it, whether it should be counted, how it should be counted, but it's not something with the reserves of the central bank that they bought on the market and they've accumulated over the years, or it's part of their wealth fund or something like that. No, this is something that actually belongs to the banks themselves.
And the foreign reserves. What about the bank's foreign reserves?
Yeah.
Because they are the ones that they are depleted now. If you're trying to support the currency with the numbers that we've seen in December, which was very sizable, what about the stock of foreign reserves as an instrument to support the currency?
It is not an option because it's almost there's nothing left in there. And I think that brings back to the point that Refet was talking about the interest rates and credibility. If you have very small reserves, the more you use them, actually, it potentially has a negative effect because people know that you will run out very quickly at this pace. And it's actually reducing credibility of the central bank on the market. So I think it's almost even not doing it is better. For credibility, given how little you have relative to the size of the market.
So how does Refet, how does the consumer, you know, exchange everything into dollar? I mean, you started by saying that actually we have an implicit dollarization now, but where do the people find dollars if they're certain?
Well, I mean, so you don't need an implicit dollarization. We have a very explicit dollarization. Let me first say a word on Elina's point, which is absolutely right. Two things. One is, so the current big thing that goes on in the central bank's reserves is the flip side of the dollarization, which is people want to save in foreign currency. Let's call them all dollars. So banks get this influx of dollar liabilities in terms of dollar deposits. Now, what do you do with those dollars? as a Turkish bank operating in Turkey, when you're getting all these dollars, what do you do with them? Because it's not easy to lend in dollars. So there was this huge market in London where these dollars that were created in the Turkish banking system were swapped for liras from London. So there is a lira-dollar swap market. There was a lira-dollar swap market in London that was huge. And this operated in general by the Turkish banks providing foreign currency and receiving liras from London. But in times of stress, the channel reversed. Foreign banks wanted Turkish liras so that they could sell the liras, thinking that the lira is going to depreciate. That was their way of shorting the lira, right? So the regulator effectively banned this. They killed this London market. And the central bank substituted itself as the swap partner and said, bring your foreign currency to me and I will swap it with you for liras, right? Mm. That's huge. And excluding the central bank's foreign currency liabilities and excluding the swaps, which are not on-budget items, the net debt reserves is something on the order of minus $50 billion. And that's the answer to your question. Can they intervene? They cannot. Of course, intervention further works when you have a temporary, in a sense, mispricing, right? You know, people get scared. They're just running for exits, whatever. So you intervene because there was no reason for them to run to begin with. But if the reason of the run is your own policy and you're not changing that policy and you're just throwing your reserves at it, there is no end to this. You cannot offset bad monetary policy by selling your reserves. It just ends in having sold your reserves, which is what happened in Turkey. But the answer to your other question, you know, where do they find the dollars, is one shouldn't be thinking of you go to a corner exchange shop, you know, give your liras and take dollars in the green pieces of paper. This really is an electronic entry, right? I could just on my cell phone enter my app for my bank and say, you know, I'd like to convert my liras to dollars and it'll be done, right? Until I want to either withdraw these in cash or want to transfer them out, the bank doesn't actually have to create this dollar asset, right? It's just a shift in the liability of the bank. It has to hold reserves against this, but nothing really has happened in the country that requires finding these dollars until I want them as dollars to be kept in the country or to be sent out of the country.
Sounds like a very unstable system, huh? Because, I mean, at some point there will be a, it seems like the seeds of panic are being sown.
So this is not different from any other country. In any country where people are free to have foreign currency accounts, this is how things work, right? We're not in a gold standard where you have to be lugging gold around. Bank accounts are just electronic entries. So when you say, I sold this, I bought that, right? It's just an electronic entry that says, okay, now I'm keeping your account in dollars. Then you have so many dollars here, okay? But then isn't any different from any banking pathology in the sense that, you know, what happens to any bank if everybody wants to withdraw their deposits, right?
In dollars.
It's a bank run. It's a bank run in any currency.
Sure.
Now, on the upside, if it's in your own currency, your central bank can just create it and provide liquidity. Sure. If it's in foreign currency, you can't do that. And that's the big deal, right? That's why you have the reserves. If there is a demand, you can just say, okay, you know, here's the foreign currency you wanted. And right. We're not able to do it in Turkey now.
That's right. And that of course, it's exactly boils down to the central bank being able to honor these dollar liabilities. And if there are not enough dollars, is there a danger of sort of, you know, Turkish bank being cut out of the market, isn't that of the country itself being cut out of the market? The answer is yes. But, you know, how imminent is this danger? Which, of course, brings me to my big question. What happens next? I know, Refet, you said that there is no substitute for good policies. I'm into that, I think. That's always true in any case. It's also true in Turkey. So that would be one thing. But if you were to take a one-year view, and perhaps I just ask you, Elena, to look a little bit in your crystal ball and tell us what do you think is going to happen in the policy horizon 2 years from now?
Well, I think what's happening now, the reason it's taking so long for a panic, for a crisis to take hold, is other good policies
thankfully,
in 2000s.
Thankfully.
Yeah, exactly. Thankfully, other good policies in 2000s. So you can think of the economy of like a chair of different legs, right? So we have sawn off the central bank leg practically now. but you still have the fiscal lag. You know, there is debt to GDP potential will be 45% this year. It's not outrageous, especially by emerging market and global standards nowadays, right? Then you have very strong financial system, the banking system, again, that we're shaking that, but we haven't fully sewn it off. So that's why the economy is still finding its way. You still have a capital account. And as Refit explained, you have very dynamic financial system and the households who can easily convert to different currencies and very sort of very good payment system, right? So we haven't sewn that off. So what I think happens next is we go more into administrative controls on the monetary side. We continue sort of now moving on to messing with the financial system itself. You know, this is so pressure on the clients. Export proceeds already, there are requirements for export proceeds. We're now putting more pressure also on the treasury. This idea of FX-linked lira deposits, you know, have you seen that before in other countries? Yes, we have seen it. Does it end well? No, it doesn't end well. But here you have a lira deposit, which is linked to foreign exchange. The treasury guarantees that. That means the treasury will bear a cost. And it's sort of supposed to pay, I think, Refit will correct me, I think it's 14%, right? It sounds almost like some of the schemes we have seen in the Lebanese banking system before, right? Or in other countries, which eventually ended up with a crisis.
I guess two important things here, both of which Elena brought up is, one, you know, we know next to nothing about state banks, but the private banks are well-capitalized and well-run. They actually know what they're doing. And in a very unexpected turn of events, the regulator forces the banks to do stupid things, unhealthy things, and banks find ways of not doing that. So they have changed hats. That's what's keeping the system going now, because although people want to keep foreign currency, they're happy to keep the foreign currency in the Turkish system. They trust the Turkish system, and I think it actually is trustworthy. Okay. But you know, messing with this too much is risky on that front, right? On the fiscal side, debt to GDP is low by emerging market standards. It's not low by Turkish standards. And in fact, the market pricing clearly signals that we don't have that much of a fiscal space, right? You know, mm-hmm. when Turkey tries to borrow in dollars, at 10 years, we pay about 8% per year. This is compared to 1.8% for the US, right? That's the lender's market's way of saying, you know, you don't have much scope to borrow.
Yeah.
And that follows directly from the fact that Turkey has a narrow tax base. Two-thirds of taxes are indirect taxes, value-added tax type taxes. So raising more taxes requires raising the value-added tax rate, which is directly inflationary, which the governments don't like to do. But that automatically limits the amount of debt repayment capacity. And therefore, there is only so much we can borrow. I think it's important to keep that in mind, that we don't have much fiscal scope here, because any fiscal intervention will require borrowing, and the interest rates aren't low. And in particular, the flip side of the rundown of the central bank reserves is, over the past 3 years, what used to be primarily private sector foreign currency debt got converted into a public sector foreign currency debt. Essentially, the public sector took over the foreign currency exposure of the private sector, leading to a rundown in the reserves and the Treasury's borrowing composition moving very quickly into anything but fixed rate Turkish lira debt. So we cannot inflate away the debt. And when the lira loses value, actually, this is a not small burden on the Treasury already, because a lot of the debt is either in foreign currency or indexed to foreign currency or indexed to inflation or floating rate, all of which go up when the exchange rate goes up.
So there is no there is no fiscal space, and therefore, you know, monetary policy, it again bears a lot of the cost. And if you do it the wrong way, that actually makes the system in a vicious cycle. But Elena, you wanted to say something, one more point you were making?
Yes, I think it's the key point I was trying to make is that I think the sort of the unhappy crisis, to be honest, are the same. We know the clear rule book, right? So the monetary policy is off. I expect more capital control management measures for sure. And
yeah,
we already see the signs of that. These are the early steps. It's almost the rule book. We know they go down the list, export controls, this and that. Then potentially you will get to individuals' ability to convert into FX just because you will have no other option. And then also, as Refet also was saying, the next step, we're putting more and more pressure on the fiscal. We switched to foreign exchange debt. We forced Treasury to insure this deposit, to sort of take the responsibility for the FX tax deposits. We have removed foreign participation from the local market, partially by design. But that means also we're putting pressure more on the domestic financial system to take this Treasury debt, right? So we would like to raise indirect taxes, and some of them are being increased. But we cannot do that because we have high inflation. So fiscal continues to deteriorate. And then finally, that all links into the financial system, which in the end ends up with sort of some form of financial repression. And for now, especially privately owned banks are resisting that. But for how much longer they will be able to resist? So we're going sort of item by item, monetary policy, capital controls, treasury, debt management, and then it's sort of integrated into that cycle as the domestic financial system. And we're trying to remove each one of those pieces. And I think that's where we continue with that. And to be able to protect a little bit the lira, I think it will have to go the more sort of the capital flow management measures or whatever you call them, but some sort of administrative measures.
Yeah, Refat, that's pretty clear what you said, Elina. So what's your, from Turkey, how do you see the policy responses evolving in the next 2 years?
Well, one thing that obviously interplays with this is the politics. And the fact that the latest in June 2023, there will be elections. So now this was briefly mentioned that the Treasury instituted this oddball policy of guaranteeing return that is not less than the depreciation of the currency to deposit holders. What they said was, okay, you know, put your money in these special time deposits. You're going to receive interest in liras on them. But these are lira deposits, right? And when the time comes, when the maturity comes, the interest you receive is less than the depreciation of the currency, so that in hindsight, you would have gained more from having bought foreign currency at the time you opened this account. We will make up for the difference. So you're not going to lose against the foreign currency. Now, this is something that works briefly because you're giving people a gift of a free option and they're happy to take it. And in particular, what we see is a lot of conversion of Turkish lira deposits. So people who are already saving in liras are happy to save in these special accounts with the option, right? Much less in terms of conversions from foreign currency deposits. But this is the kind of policy that's going to help you for a few months until the currency begins to depreciate and people realize, ooh, this is going to be such a huge burden on the treasury that they will have to monetize. This is eventually going to come out of the central bank in liras, which is going to further reinforce the depreciation, and you're going to go into this depreciationary spiral, which is essentially what happened in the 97-98 Asian crisis, that people understood that there was this implicit guarantee on foreign liabilities of the banking system, and understood that if the currency depreciated fast, banks would be insolvent, treasuries would have to pay for this, they wouldn't have the foreign currency to pay for it, and therefore they would have to monetize it, which would reinforce the depreciation of the currency. So we got ourselves into that. But of course, this becomes an issue only when the maturity of these things come. And the shortest one is 3 months, right? So there's this kind of a grace period for a while where you could do things. The sad thing here is if we were transitioning to a sane policy framework, this would have actually bought us time. Right. If you said, okay, you know, we're going to use this to change the monetary policy framework, interest rates are going to go up, you know, we're going to somehow put together a credible team of economists who are going to, you know, run the treasury, the central bank, whatnot. But the root cause of institutional decay and inane policies continue. And so you're buying time to do nothing with it. And you're not buying time for free. It comes this fiscal cost that is going to be a major burden.
What is the social cost of all of this?
Deep unhappiness, right? People finding it, the general social cost of, I mean, part of it, I would say, is this general feeling of a crisis, yeah. Right? And if you've ever lived through an economic crisis, you know what it feels like. The other one is the general, again, destructive effects of fast depreciation and high inflation, which is you have no idea how much you're going to pay when you walk into a store. Your understanding of relative prices is lost. You don't understand whether this item is too expensive, whether this store is ripping me off. Or is this a manifestation of everything is too expensive anyway now? For firms that are indebted in foreign currency, it's a terrible thing that the lira has depreciated so much. And that, right, we are a huge energy importer, so energy prices go up. That has ripple effects on everything. So I would say the social effects are as expected and, you know, deeply upsetting.
Yeah. So I think, Elena, your point about moving into some sort of an administrative regime, and actually, paradoxically, administrative regime actually tend to help with the governance, because Refet's point is that the governance issues are at the root of all of this, right? And there need are governance issues in terms of, you know, independent central banks, or you don't agree, or?
No, that's not the kind of administrative regime I was thinking about. I was thinking about the manual management kind of regime that tries to patch up all the bad policies that you're doing with some sort of little fig leaves and trying to arm twist economic participants to cooperate with your new economic model for a little bit longer. Yeah. So I think that's the kind of administrative regime that I was thinking about. More export controls, potentially controls on individuals' ability to convert, or making it more difficult to convert in the beginning, or sort of following up on who is doing what on the conversion side. So these are the sort of the typical list of capital flow, capital management, or capital restrictions in the short run. You can also move with the price restrictions, you know, may pretend inflation is not there, do administrative restrictions on some of the goods, on some of the socially sensitive goods. But it's, again, it's not addressing the key root of the problem. And in terms of the lost opportunity for people, I think it's a huge direct loss of income, especially for households, but also for corporates. It is also a lost opportunity when the European Union, especially with the common support against COVID pandemic, and also looking forward to sort of maybe more regionalization of your value supply chains. Turkey stands fantastically to benefit from that, you know, with still very strong corporate sector, was sort of a still very educated population. It could be sort of, it could just sort of plug itself into that wonderfully if it were not in the middle of the financial and balance of payments crisis.
I would agree with this, with an exception, in that you know, by profession and what this program is, we're talking about the Turkish economy. But whatever shortcomings, bad policy decisions, pathologies we talk about the Turkish economy, of course, are present in all other spheres of governance too. It's not that in a country that is otherwise run well, it so happens that we're doing some crazy economic experiments and seeing bad results of that. The country is overall badly run. And so the social policies, the political inclusion, the general administration of the country, I guess my point here is there isn't a Turkish economy separate from Turkey. The foreign exchange and exchange rates are very visible and very responsive to developments, you know, being liquid and forward-looking asset prices. But, you know, you can see signs of the same things in the approval of the government. The point here is, you know, which wasn't what Elena was saying, but it's important not to have the impression that, you know, things would be so fine had there not been this economic crisis. There is a general lack of governance, general lack of any coherent framework towards any policy goals. The economic outcomes of this are very visible now, but it's pervasive. It's on all spheres of policymaking, and it will have to be that these are collectively fixed. There is no way of just fixing the Turkish economy.
Yeah. Now, listen, we are slowly coming to the end of our podcast. Very sobering news from both of you. Well, thank you very much for coming and for helping us clarify some of the issues. It's been extremely illuminating understanding what is driving all of this. I'm hoping that if next year we have another one of these, we have a bit better news, particularly on the governance side, which I tend to agree with Refet. It's really at the core of good economic outcomes, and not just in Turkey, everywhere, we see huge correlations between the two. So if I had one wish, and I don't know what your wish would be fix that. And if you fix that, then you fix a lot of other things you can fix without immense cost. But anyway, I'm hoping you can come back at a later stage and we can have an update on what has happened. But for the moment, this is all we have time for today. Thank you very much, Elena, Refet. Thank you for joining us from across the world. Thank you, the listeners, for tuning in today. All of this will be on our website and more of publications at Bruegel at www.bruegel.org. Join us next time. And for the moment, thank you very much and bye-bye.
Thank you and goodbye.
Thank you. Thank you so much.